Hello and welcome to Pod's Own Country, the Yorkshire Post's political podcast. I'm Rob Parsons, the Yorkshire Post's political editor, and what a varied episode we have for you this week. Our guest today is the Conservative Morley MP, Andrea Jenkins, who will be talking about one of her big areas of interest and something she's been lobbying hard on recently, namely animal welfare. So we'll be talking about pet theft and puppy smuggling, as well as the intensive farming methods and what impact Brexit and future trade deals might have on those. Andrea actually has her own podcast on animal welfare issues. So if you're an animal lover, you'll want to hear, I'm sure, what she has to say. But before we get onto that, let's talk about a topic that also fires up very strong feelings, and that's the issue of Leeds Bradford Airport and its proposed development, which would involve a £150 million new terminal. And if you want a sense of the kind of interest it's provoking, in the last few days, climate activists have travelled down to Westminster to hand deliver a 54,000 signature petition to the government calling for a public inquiry into the plans. So we're all currently awaiting the next move from Community Secretary Robert Jenrick as he, like the rest of us, attempts to weigh up the competing arguments put forward on climate change and the interests of the region's economy. Now, someone who's been following this story all the way from the beginning is Mark Cassie, the Yorkshire Post's business editor, and he's joining us today to talk about where things currently stand. Mark, hello.
Hello, Rob. How are you?
Very good. I'm very good, thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. So, there might be a few people who don't know what all the fuss is about with Leeds Bradford Airport. Can you just explain initially what are the airport bosses proposing to do?
So what Leeds Bradford Airport wants to do and what its parent company AMP Capital is prepared to fund is to demolish the current terminal building, which we all know is not the nicest in terms of passenger experience. They want to knock that down and they want to construct in its place a 150 million, 34,000 square foot terminal building that will be over three floors. It will have the highest possible environmental rating and, perhaps most importantly, it will be situated on a different part of the airport site. It will be situated closer to Scotland Road, which is the actual location of it isn't important to the listener. What is important is that the big problem that Leeds Bradford Airport has is accessibility. You can only get there by road or bus. It's in the middle of a very densely populated residential area, and getting there can be somewhat troublesome. But where they're proposing to build this new terminal, it will be closer to a proposed railway link station, which would be situated on the Leeds to Harrogate line, which would allow people to access the airport much more comfortably. And it would also hugely improve the passenger experience and would allow them to attract more airlines and fly to more destinations, because currently we all know that there's a huge propensity of people driving in their cars or travelling by rail to Manchester or to Heathrow to fly to destinations. A former chief executive of Leeds Bradford Airport once told me that the airport was a bucket and spade airport, and by that he meant that it's a place where you go for a weekend break or somewhere with your family. There isn't a huge amount of commercial business travel options from the airport. So that's the plan. And as I say, the airport bosses there have managed to convince the parent company to fund this in full. So they're confident that it can go ahead. It's worth pointing out that Leeds is the fourth biggest city region in the country, but it's got the 15th biggest airport. We don't exactly roll out the red carpet when people arrive by air into the city, and they're more likely to arrive in Manchester and get the train over. So in terms of inward investment, in terms of the message we send about the region and its economy and its culture, it's not great.
You often hear about the airport's plans being described as an expansion. And I know you don't like that phrase. I've seen on Twitter you disputing that. Can you explain why it's not an expansion?
The reason I don't like it being called an expansion is it implies that it's going to be a gigantic step forward, both in terms of the geographical footprint of the airport, perhaps even alludes to the fact that there'll be additional runways, and it alludes to the fact as well that there's going to be an increase in passenger numbers. Now, listen, Leeds Bradford Airport already has a pre-existing planning application in to rejig the airport and to increase its ability to fly passengers. It currently flies 4 million a year. It wants to up that to 7 million a year. That application has already been agreed by Leeds City Council. So the airport has got no plans to fly any additional services off the back of this. But somehow in the sort of debate around this issue, it's been turned into almost like a referendum, essentially, on air travel itself, which we all know, and I don't think anyone would dispute, is a contributor to emissions, which damage the environment. But look, the plan is already there in place to increase passenger numbers to 7 million. This has got absolutely nothing to do with that. It just wants to make the airport more attractive to carriers and to passengers. That's the sum total of it. And I don't think it can achieve its goal of doing those things if it has the pre-existing terminal building, which was built in the 1960s, is very dilapidated and doesn't offer a good experience to passengers. So I don't think it's an expansion. It's an improvement, or it's a revamp, or it's an upgrade would be a much more accurate way of describing it using language. But in terms of, you know, this idea that we'd have additional runways, you know, we all saw the Ferrari over the additional runway at Heathrow. This has got absolutely no part whatsoever in this debate. It's an upgrade of a terminal building, and that's where the debate starts and finishes, frankly.
And what stage are things up to at the moment? It feels like it's been rumbling on for years, but there's been various different bodies that have been sort of weighing in on it. Where are things at currently?
So I first broke this story that they wanted to do with the airport in January of last year. And then, of course, we all know what happened to the world during that period. But listen, it went before planners at Leeds City Council in February. The debate took 8 hours, which is an absolute marathon session by anyone's estimation. So no one can argue that it wasn't properly scrutinised. There was more than 25 objectors spoke at that meeting, as well as representatives of the airport and the wider business community throwing in their opinions. It was approved by Leeds City Council by 9-5. So, you know, this is elected democratically elected people in our city who have the mandate to make decisions on such matters. They approved it. And then it's been called into the Department for Communities and Local Government to have that scrutinised. And the Community Secretary of State, Robert Jenrick, has essentially kicked it into the long grass for the time being. He wants more time to have a look at it. So rather frustratingly, we are kind of once again in the hands of Whitehall, rather than having the decision made locally where people know the issues and can properly debate them and scrutinise them. We're now essentially waiting for people in Whitehall to sign this off. The time frame for when that's going to happen, I have no idea. I don't think anyone does, other than perhaps a small handful of mandarins in Westminster, but we're in their hands currently.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I guess it's it was around a similar time, I think, that Robert Jenrick decided to call in the application for the big coal mine in Cumbria. Yeah. And there's sort of similar topics and considerations in play. I want to put to you something that we've quoted in an article this week. As I said, a load of climate activists have descended on Westminster to hand in this petition with tens of thousands of signatures. And one of the protesters, Martha Dacom, said, "This is not just about Leeds Bradford Airport. We're on the brink of climate and ecological breakdown, yet airports throughout the country are trying to expand. Approving Leeds Bradford Airport's application would open the floodgates of expansion at other airports." Now, obviously, bearing in mind what you just said about expansion, I'm sure you'd take issue with some of that. But do you understand the concerns that people like Martha Dacom have?
I absolutely understand them. And listen, I applaud Martha and her colleagues for having the sort of activism zeal to pursue this so readily. But listen, on the environmental score, let's be very factual about this. No one is disputing that air travel is a polluting way of travelling and getting around. My response to that would be, do we really think that blocking this application to get a new terminal building in, not allowing it to go ahead, is that really going to result in a net reduction in people choosing to fly around the world? I think that's, frankly, just not got any factual basis. All that's going to happen is people are going to get into the cars, they're going to get on the M62, and they're going to drive to Manchester, or they're going to drive down to Heathrow. So you kind of have the worst of all worlds. We have a very poor aviation offering in our city region, which massively holds back our economy and people's job prospects and the ability for us to be a thriving European city. And we have the pollution still from the air travel and an increase from the car journeys as well. What I would say on this as well, and this is extremely important, and I haven't heard anyone really from the those opposing the airport really kind of come up with a valid response on this, is, I mean, let's just look at what's happened with the travel industry in general. Let's think about electric cars. 5 years ago, I would suggest that none of us really knew anyone who had an electric car, or if we did, it tended to be a very small number of very wealthy people that had them. Now electric cars are becoming increasingly commonplace. You see chargings. I mean, look, think about our office building. We haven't been there for a while, but there used to be one charging point for an electric car. Now there's dozens. the pressure is on from politics to business of all kinds to reduce your emissions. We look at what Joe Biden's been doing. We look at our own government's target. We look at what the EU's doing. We look at every government around the world. They're all pressurizing industries to reduce their emissions. And that is inevitably going to happen with the aviation industry. Airbus is already talking about having a low emission aircraft potentially being able to start flying in 5 years. We're making what, in my opinion, is, you know, we can't base this on short-term thinking. The aviation industry will, for want of a better expression, start to greening itself in short order. And if we disallow this application to have a decent airport in the Leeds City region, all we're doing is disadvantaging the entire region, because those planes will be taken off from Manchester, Newcastle, Heathrow, Gatwick, you name it, and we won't have it because we chose to go down this route in Leeds. So I really would urge people to not engage too much in short-term thinking. I'm very confident that the industry will innovate to reduce their emissions. And listen, I completely sympathise with their argument. Aviation, as I said, is a very polluting way to get around, but we can't ignore the fact that international travel is a part of modern life, perhaps not so much in the last 15 months, but people like to travel. They like to see the world. And, you know, frankly, when my daughters grow up, I want them to be able to see as much of the world as possible. I still intend to travel as much as I can. You know, we can't just cut them off at the knees, essentially, by basing our thinking on current technologies. So that's something I'm very, very keen to put out there. And, you know, let's be clear, the Olympic Games in 2012, the M62, the M1, the London Underground, all of these things at the time, people didn't want them to go ahead because they were expensive or they didn't like the look of them. Innovation and progress comes at a cost, but I think the return on investment for having a first-class airport and a first-class economy could be a really strong one for the region, and I really hope it goes ahead.
Mark, thank you very much. It's, I guess it'll be all eyes on Robert Jenrick in the coming weeks and months to see what he comes up with in this area, and it's going to run and run the debate on this, I'm sure. So, Mark, thank you again for that. And let's now hear what our guest today has to say. Our guest today on Podzone Country will be talking about a subject that will be very close to the heart, to people's hearts, namely animal welfare. Britain is said to be a nation of animal lovers, and a poll in 2019 revealed that 15% of us love our pets more than we love our partners. But despite this, cruelty to animals is alarmingly common, whether it's organised dog fighting or cockfighting, animal abuse in the factory farming industry, or the cruelty and neglect inflicted on pets by their owners. According to the Humane Society, the shocking number of animal cruelty cases reported every day is just the tip of the iceberg, and most cases are never actually reported. So someone who's taken a keen interest in this is the Conservative MP for Morley in West Yorkshire, Andrea Jenkins, who has her own animal welfare podcast, Andrea's Animal Welfare, and has raised issues such as trophy hunters in Parliament. But something she's particularly interested in is the issue of puppy smuggling and dog theft, and that's what she's here to talk about today. So, Andrea, welcome to our podcast. How are you doing today?
Thank you so much for bringing me on, and I love your wallpaper. It's absolutely amazing.
Good. You're not the first person to compliment my Orla Keely wallpaper, so thank you for that. So, as a starting point, what got you interested in animal welfare in the first place? You were just saying before we came on that you're a vegetarian, you have been a vegan. What's got you interested in this initially?
I've always been interested in it. I mean, I was, even as a child, bringing home a three-legged stray dog one time when I was little that I saw on the street. And so it's something I've always been interested in, and hence why I'm a vegetarian, et cetera. And I was a vegan for 5 years. I've always raised money for animal welfare charities as well through my singing. And when I became an MP, I then looked at more at the policy side. So I've worked with Brian May on the fox hunting and the badger cull, because I'm very passionately against both of those. I've worked with Mark Abraham, the TV vet, on Lucy's Law regarding puppy smuggling, and I've done a lot with the Dogs Trust on puppy smuggling over the years as well, and held several informative briefings and receptions in Parliament on this issue, and also even with Bill Oddie on Fragua, because the thing is, when we was part of the EU, we couldn't ban it in this country because of, you know, France, it being a delicacy. But that's something we, you know, that is a proposed Brexit opportunity.
Yeah, we'll get onto that topic a little later. But on the subject of puppy smuggling and dog theft, I was the Yorkshire Post reported a few weeks ago that this is happening in Yorkshire, and confirmed dog thefts climbed to 25 in the past year compared with 18 in the previous year. And there's talk of demand for designer puppies sort of rocketing over the course of the pandemic. So what's going on with this? Like, why is this happening?
Yeah, I mean, so if we can take it back first, because puppy smuggling, because it's all sort of joined in a way. So if we can touch on puppy smuggling first, if that's okay, then move on to the pet theft. I mean, while we're part of the EU, you know, the pet travel scheme was brought in 2012. And what that allowed it, for was, you know, one person could bring five pets, as in dogs, over on that one passport. So you'd be getting, you know, men with vans, puppy smugglers, you know, three or four men in a van, each being able to bring five puppies themselves and bring them over to the UK. But their starting life was really dire. I mean, I actually unwittingly got a Godiva, my mini schnauzer, from a puppy farm in Lincolnshire 11 years ago. So it's so easy to get duped. I mean, it presented itself as a wonderful place. It was clean. It even had somewhere where you could buy all the pet beds and food and everything. But this place ended up getting closed down. And I remember Godiva, my little dog, she couldn't even, she'd never seen grass before. Had such a sad start in life that she started howling when I put her in the garden. So the pet travel scheme, I think, has got a lot to be answered for. And I mean, imported puppies in the UK has got a street value of over £3 million. And I mean, I noticed in the Google searches, you know, during lockdown, for buy a puppy increased something like 166%, which it was a lonely time for people. So more people was looking for pets and for companionship, but it was exasperating the situation with this illegal puppy farming. So I've worked with a dogs trust on this issue over the years, and Mark Abraham, as I said, the TV vet. So if I can just sort of, if you don't mind, give some sort of tips on what came out of working with these and what people should look for to make sure that they are, you know, getting a dog what, you know, is bred in a kind way.
Of course. Yes. Go ahead. It'd be good for people to hear some of the tips.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that Mark Abraham was really pushing, and the Dogs Trust, is, you know, go and see the puppy. There's so many adverts out there on Preloved and even on eBay. And always be mindful if you see pictures of the puppies where they're not with their mother. And when you actually visit to collect the pet, if it's not with a mother, then alarm bells can should start ringing, because the puppy smugglers, they even can rent a place and make out you're going to somebody's home to actually sell these puppies, who I said have had a horrible start in life. So always ask to see the mum. And ask if it's been imported. And if it's under 15 weeks, then that means it would have been illegally imported. And expect the breeder to be asking lots of questions as well, because a responsible breeder should be making sure that their puppies go to a good home. So the warning signs are that if you can't view the puppy with a mum, there's no image of the mum on the advert. It's just image on the pups on their own. If the seller is offering multiple breeds for sale, this is what happened with me, actually, when I got Godiva, or offering to deliver you the puppy, see that as a warning sign. Because, I mean, you do sort of think, oh, well, at least that puppy's going to a good home. But it's much better if we, you know, if we get puppies from other routes, and then there won't be a demand for this. So this is sort of where we are at with it. I mean, Lucy's Law, which was Mark Abraham's baby, so to speak, in April 2020, so last year, we we had a ban on third-party sales that came into force in England, which requires all dogs under 6 months of age to be bought directly from the breeder or from a rescue centre. So that is certainly a move in the right direction with this. But I'm happy to touch on the pet theft side unless you've got any questions on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, with so the fact that Lucy's Law has come in and means that the sales have to be via a breeder, does that mean that puppy smuggling is much more difficult to do now, or can it still happen if the people who want to do it are sort of sufficiently determined?
Yes, I mean it can still happen because they find more ways of cracking down. Of actually avoiding the law. But I know early this month the government launched a government action plan for animal welfare, and this actually includes looking at puppy smuggling. And they're actually, working with the crime unit to actually see ways of how these unscrupulous puppy smugglers avoid the law. And look at ways on how we can catch them at it, tougher penalties for puppy smuggling to deter deceitful sellers. But I think the most important thing that we can do is raise awareness, because if there's not a demand there, then it's going to be harder for them to sell it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you say, it's a combination of the fact that these the puppy smugglers are able to do it, and also the demand that during the pandemic, people, they want companionship, and they you can, for understandable reasons, think that getting a puppy might be a good idea.
Yes.
So with Godiva, your mini schnauzer lab, did the fact when you discovered that it had come from a puppy farm, like, did that change sort of how you treated Godiva, or did you feel like you needed to take more care of them after that?
I mean, I didn't actually find out until I became an MP, and it was actually working with the charities, etc. And I happened to mention, I won't mention the name of this, the premises where I bought it from, but it was because I got it from Lincolnshire. You don't keep an eye on the news there, but it was actually speaking to these charities and said, "Oh, do you realise that got closed down? That was one of the puppy farms." But no, I mean, Godiva, she's a wonderful dog, and she's with us. She's 11 now, but I think back to that sad moment when she, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, she'd never even seen grass, and She's a very clingy dog, bless her. But also, I mean, I'd always recommend as well getting a rescue puppy. A couple of years ago, I've got a rescue centre in my village where I live in the constituency. And I got Susie, a rescue centre. I was actually just going on a constituency visit, and Cameron from my team saw me falling in love with this puppy, not puppy, this this dog, Susie, a little terrier, and she's now a welcome member of our family. So even doing that route is wonderful, giving that dog, a better chance.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's lovely to hear. So on pet thefts, which is, I guess, is a related but sort of distinct issue. So my understanding is that at the moment, pet theft is not classed as a separate offence to theft of personal property, and that's what campaigners say should be changed. I think so. There's the Theft Act 1968, under which dog thefts can be punished by up to 7 years imprisonment. But the issue seems to be that this doesn't take into account the sort of emotional impact that victims of pet theft face. I mean, is that pretty much your position on
it? Yes, yeah, completely. I mean, I was campaigning during the local elections, as most MPs were, to support their councillors, candidates. And I got this on the doorstep only in the last few weeks, where I've got residents who said to me, it came up several times, that they've got a dog, they don't even take their dog out for a walk at the moment because of how pet theft has massively increased. I mean, I've got some stats here. In 2020, an estimated 2,400 dogs were reported stolen, lost or stolen to the police, and which is a 19% rise compared to the previous year. So it is a massive increase. But you're so right. I mean, this is so important that there's always got to be a consequence of actions. And I always believe in being strong where law's concerned. But I know that the government has now set up this, it's a pet task force. And they're going to gather evidence contributing to the perceived rise of thefts. And they're actually going to learn lessons from thefts such as mobile phone, metal theft, and really see how you can trace items and how the illegal market engages with the public, so we can help to recover these stolen pets. Speaking to charities, there's actually some advice. I mean, for example, the Blue Cross offers some excellent guidance. They always say, always microchip collar and ID tag on your pets. But don't put the dog's name on the tag, as it makes it easier for the pets to lure them away. And which is something I would never have thought of, because automatically we put the dog's name on, but I think that's such a good idea. And out and about, if you see strangers asking lots of questions about your dog, really start varying the routes and times that you walk. And importantly as well, make sure your garden's secure. So what can be done in the future? Yes, I'd like to see really strong sentences, but I'd want to see what this pet theft task force, what the government's put into place, what suggestions that they come up with to outlaw this.
Yeah, because we were discussing beforehand that prior to the local elections, the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, was in York, I think, visiting a kennels, and she spoke about dog thefts, and she said they were tragic and vowed to crack down on them, and saying she absolutely supports calls to make this a crime in its own right. And obviously, I guess a task force is a step on the road to achieving that. But you, just to be clear, you would like it to be considered a separate offence to just theft of an inanimate object.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pets are part of people's family, aren't they? My two have the full run of the house. They even sleep on the bottom of my bed. And they offer so much companionship for those who haven't got families. So, to lose a dog, I mean, I remember growing up, gosh, how old would I have been? About 10 years old, and we had a dog called Shadow, who actually was, we had its mother, and our dog Shadow went missing, and we never found out where she went as well. So, and I still think about her to this day. You never forget, it leaves a lasting mark when a dog goes missing who's actually a family member. So we it's got to be seen as more than an object, a thing. This is somebody who people hold close to their hearts.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you about a related issue on the animal welfare theme. And you're an ardent Brexiteer, that's no secret. And you recently wrote that Brexit will allow global Britain to lead the way on farm animal welfare standards. Can you explain a bit more about what you meant by that?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, looking at some of the issues with the EU, as I said earlier in the podcast, first of all, let's not forget, I mean, I think we're fourth in the world on animal welfare standards, third or fourth. And so we are up there with the best anyway. But while we're part of the EU, we couldn't be as good as we wanted. As I mentioned earlier, I worked with Bill Oddie in Parliament on his campaign to ban foie gras, which we couldn't do because of France, it being a delicacy there. So, having been free from the EU, it does allow us to really start looking at, our own practices and what we do here in the UK.
Okay, I guess there'll be people who are hearing that, and they'll be saying, well, hang on, when the UK signs a trade deal with Australia or the US, our animal welfare standards may not change, but we're going to be opening the door to products that have come from an environment that has much lower animal welfare standards than we do. Obviously, well,
like
about
the EU, I'm afraid, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, everyone talks about the chlorinated chicken, don't they, in
but
the
can
US.
Can I just say about chlorinated chicken? I've probably got an unusual view, and I don't mind it being out there. But to me, chlorinated chicken is clean chicken. My dad died from MRSA. Yeah. When he caught an infection, I'd much rather have food what's been cleaned. So I think we actually need to blow the lid off what does that actually mean as well.
Is my understanding with chlorinated chicken is that it's not the fact that it's chlorinated which is the issue, it's the fact that the chlorination process sort of hides defects or illnesses within the chicken, and that it's more of a sort of symptom of the poor welfare standards of the birds themselves. But I mean,
here in the UK, we have enough chickens to, I mean, I always believe that, you know, food in general should have the origin, country of origin on there. I always believe that, for example, even halal meat, it should be labelled halal. So people, I believe in freedom of choice. People should know what they're buying and what's going to be on their dinner plate. But talking about Australia, well, we don't know what the trade deal's going to be yet. We're going to know shortly. So I won't want to preempt on this because as we've seen, you know, with media and we often hear the hype of issues and they don't materialise. So, and I know that, let's face it, we've got one of the not only greenest governments, but one of the best governments that has seen for a generation who's really tough on animal welfare. So I'd be very surprised if we actually adopt something that isn't within our keeping. I mean, I know there's a lot of misinformation out there. I mean, there was an article in a national newspaper recently and it was talking about feedlots, for example, which is actually grain-fed cattle and in Australia. But we have such stuff like this, you know, we have these in the UK. I've got some pictures here of some of our animals in the UK. You know, this is here in the UK where our cows are all, it's not a very good copy, it's on my printer, which I can send some of the pictures later if you're on, where this is our animals here in the UK where they, you know, they are closer to together when they've been fed, etc. But let's not, so we've got a lot in our own animal welfare standards to improve. Yes, we might be global leading, but we can still do so much more. But let's not forget, we can get some great beef as well. And I'm vegetarian. I mean, Australian do some of the best in the world of their grass-fed beef. So as I said, I don't want to preempt it because we don't know what this trade deal is going to look like. But I'd be very shocked if we're going to be, you know, bringing stuff in this country which is substandard to what we would sell ourselves. But I do believe in, you know, freedom of choice. But I do believe stuff should be labelled. You must always know what you're buying.
Yeah. Well, I know there'll be a lot of farmers in across Yorkshire in our rural areas who'll be keeping a keen eye on what happens with these trade deals. But Andrea Jenkins,
buy British as well. I'm very, you know, buy Yorkshire, buy British. I'm very keen for us to do that wherever we can as well.
Absolutely. We can all get behind that, I'm sure. Andrea Jenkins, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Pods Own Country this week. I've been Rob Parsons, the Yorkshire Post political editor. And if you've liked what you've heard, do leave us a review on Apple or Google or any of the places that you get your podcast. And if you have a topic that you think we ought to be discussing on this week's episode, then do drop me an email at rob.parsons@jpimedia.co.uk or send me a message on Twitter and I'll look into it. Nice to chat to you and see you next week. Bye-bye.